Book of the Week with Claire Armistead on guardian.co.uk.
Hello, I'm Claire Armistead, and welcome to a new series, My Book of the Week. In these podcasts, I'll be talking to the author of the book that has most excited me over the last 7 days. Today I'm talking to A.S. Byatt, whose new novel, The Children's Book, is a magical exploration of childhood and storytelling, not to mention pottery, and the dark sides of fairy tale, set in the late 19th and early 20th century. I've come down to her house in South London, and it's full of lots of fairy tale sort of things. It's just how I imagined your house would be, which doesn't often happen with writers.
You know, I always worry about going to people's houses, because then the imaginary house is replaced by the real house. It's rather like meeting people. I mean, you and I have corresponded endlessly on the email about things, but we don't see each other very often.
No, absolutely. It's the word made flesh, isn't it? Now, just to introduce this novel, which is a wonderfully rich and in some ways complicated piece of storytelling, A.S. Byatt has very kindly agreed to read the opening chapter in which three of her main characters meet in the depths of the Kensington Museum, which is shortly to become the V&A.
Two boys stood in the Prince Consort Gallery and looked down on a third. It was June the 19th, 1895. The Prince had died in 1861 and had seen only the beginnings of his ambitious project for a gathering of museums in which the British craftsmen could study the best examples of design. His portrait, modest and medalled, was done in mosaic on the tympanum of a decorative arch at one end of the narrow gallery, which ran above the space of the South Court. The South Court was decorated with further mosaics, portraits of painters, sculptors, potters, the Kensington Valhalla. The third boy was squatting beside one of a series of imposing glass cases displaying gold and silver treasures. Tom, the younger of the two, looking down, thought of Snow White in her glass coffin. He thought also, looking up at Albert, that the vessels and spoons and caskets gleaming in the liquid light under the glass were like a resurrected kingly burial hoard, which indeed some of them were. They could not see the other boy clearly because he was on the far side of a case. He appeared to be sketching its contents. Julian Kane was at home in the South Kensington Museum. His father, Major Prosper Kane, was special keeper of precious metals. Julian was just 15 and a boarder at Marlow School, but was home recovering from a nasty bout of jaundice. He was neither tall nor short, slightly built, with a sharp face and a sallow complexion, even without the jaundice. He wore his straight black hair parted in the centre and was dressed in a school suit. Tom Wellwood, boyish in Norfolk jacket and breeches, was about 2 years younger, and looked younger than he was, with large dark eyes, a soft mouth, and a smooth head of dark gold hair. The two had not met before. Tom's mother was visiting Julian's father to ask for help with her research. She was a successful authoress of magical tales. Julian had been deputed to show Tom the treasures. He appeared to be more interested in showing him the squatting boy. I said I'd show you a mystery. I thought you meant one of the treasures. No, I meant him. There's something shifty about him. I've been keeping an eye on him. He's up to something. Tom was not sure whether this was the sort of make-believe his own family practiced, tracking complete strangers and inventing stories about them. He wasn't sure if Julian was, so to speak, playing at being responsible. What does he do? He does the Indian rope trick. He disappears. Now you see him, now you don't. He's here every day, all by himself, but you can't see when or where he goes. They sidled along the wrought iron gallery, which was hung with thick red velvet curtains. The third boy stayed where he was, drawing intently. Then he moved his position to see from another angle. He was hay-haired, shaggy and filthy. He had cut down workman's trousers with braces over a flannel shirt the colour of smoke, stained with soot. Julian said, "We could go down and stalk him. There are all sorts of odd things about him. He looks very rough. He never seems to go anywhere but here. I've waited at the exit to see him leave and follow him, and he doesn't seem to leave. He seems to be a permanent fixture." The boy looked up briefly, his grimy face creased in a frown. Tom said, "He concentrates. He never talks to anyone that I can see. Now and then the art students look at his drawings, but he doesn't chat to them. He just creeps about the place. It's sinister. Do you get many robberies? My father always says the keepers are criminally casual with the keys to the cases, and there are heaps and heaps of stuff lying around waiting to be catalogued or sent to Bethnal Green. It would be terribly easy to sneak off with things. I don't even know if anyone would notice if you did, not with some of the things, though they'd notice quickly enough if anyone made an attempt on the candlestick. Candlestick? The Gloucester candlestick. What he seems to be drawing a lot of the time. The lump of gold in the centre of that case. It's ancient and unique. I'll show it to you. We could go down and go up to it and disturb him. Tom was dubious about this. There was something tense about the third boy, a tough, prepared energy he didn't even realise he'd noticed. However, he agreed. He usually agreed to things. They moved sleuth-like from ambush to ambush behind the swags of velvet. They went under Prince Albert, out onto the turning stone stairs, down to the south court. When they reached the candlestick, the dirty boy was not there. "He wasn't on the stairs," said Julian, obsessed. Tom stopped to stare at the candlestick. It was dully gold. It seemed heavy. It stood on 3 feet, each of which was a long-eared dragon, grasping a bone with grim claws, gnawing with sharp teeth. The rim of the spiked cup that held the candle was also supported by open-jawed dragons with wings and snaking tails. The whole of its thick stem was wrought of fantastic foliage, amongst which men and monsters, centaurs and monkeys, writhed, grinned, grimaced, grasped and stabbed at each other. A helmeted gnome-like being with huge eyes grappled the sinuous tail of a reptile. There were other human or cobalt figures, one in particular with long, draggling hair and a mournful gaze. Tom thought immediately that his mother would need to see it. He tried and failed to memorise the shapes. Julian explained. It had an interesting history, he said. No one knew exactly what it was made of. It was some kind of gilt alloy. It was probable that it had been made in Canterbury, modelled in wax and cast, but apart from the symbols of the evangelists on the knop, it appeared not to be made for religious use. It had turned up in the cathedral at Le Mans, from where it had disappeared at the French Revolution. A French antiquary had sold it to the Russian Prince Saltykov. The South Kensington Museum had acquired it from his collection in 1861. There was nothing anywhere like it. Tom did not know what a knop was and did not know what the symbols of the evangelists were, but he saw that the thing was a whole world of secret stories. He said his mother would like to see it. It might be just what she was looking for. He would have liked to touch the heads of the dragons. Julian was looking restlessly around him. There was a concealed door behind a plaster cast of a guarding knight on a marble plinth. It was slightly ajar, which he had never seen before. He had tried its handle, and it was always as it should be, since it led down to the basement storerooms and workrooms, locked. I bet he went down there. What's down there? Miles and miles of passages and cupboards and cellars and things being moulded or cleaned or just kept. Let's stalk him. There was no light beyond what was cast on the upper steps from the door they had opened. Tom did not like the dark. He did not like transgression. He said, "We can't see where we're going. We'll leave the door open a crack. Someone may come and lock it. We may get into trouble. We won't. I live here."
There you are introduced to three of the main characters. Will you talk a little bit about these boys and the families they come to, which is actually the heart of the book?
Julian was the one who develops into somebody you wouldn't recognise from that passage. He is the son of Major Prosper Kane, who is the keeper of special metals, and he has a sister called Florence, who is also a main character in this novel.
And Prosper Kane runs the V&A, basically, so involved with founding the V&A.
Yes, indeed. The V&A, the South Kensington Museum is the predecessor of the V&A, which became the Victoria and Albert when Queen Victoria opened it much later than this point in my story. Anyway, Prosper Kane lived in it, as a lot of these military men did, sort of in houses in its courtyards, and was a widowed man with two children. and Julian is a sort of very intelligent, sort of upper class
boy as well, which and is very, one point in it, the story, isn't it? That and Tom is a sort of rural child, a free spirit to some extent. Tell us a bit about Tom and the Wellwoods, his family.
Well, the Wellwoods are a sort of archetypal Fabian family, which lives in sort of old houses in the countryside. And the children run free. And when I was a child, I read stories written by people like Olive Wellwood, who is in some ways the central figure of the book, who earns the living of the whole family by writing fairy stories and children's stories. And Tom is the eldest boy and the one to whom his mother mostly tells the fairy tales. Though each child, I think there are six children or so, has their own book in which their mother writes their personal fairy tale, which they can go and read how it's getting on. And Tom is a gentle boy, and he becomes totally involved in his mother's storytelling and the countryside. And he is destined, like Julian, to go to Cambridge, whereas Julian simply goes to Cambridge and does very well. Tom suddenly starts failing exams unexpectedly.
Now, there are an awful lot of people in this novel, and we'll come back to the unconventional family structure a bit later. The third boy in this opening scene is Philip. Tell us a bit about Philip.
Well, Philip comes from a very poor working-class family in the Potteries, and his mother was what was known as a paintress, and she painted very beautiful patterns on china tea sets and cups very repetitively. And he's the character who wants to make something.
He's come to London and is literally hiding out in the secret passages of the museum, isn't he?
He's hiding out in the basement. I'm sleeping, in fact, in an ancient Russian tomb, which really is down there. I saw it. And he's just drawing things to see, as it were, shapes that he will then put on pots. And he's very lucky because the Olive and Prosper Kane take him up because they see that his drawings are good. And he gets taken to the third family in the story, which are the Floods. There is a potter down in Dungeness called Benedict Flood, who is a leftover from the high days of the Pre-Raphaelites and makes pots like the pots made by Morris and Co. And his behaviour is not very nice and his temper is very unstable and his wife is very, very beautiful. Dante Gabriel Rossetti used to discover women, he said, were stunners. And this poor woman was a stunner who was discovered by this potter.
Who's permanently stunned all the way through the books.
Yes, and he obviously doesn't like her. And he has two daughters called Imogen and Pomona, whom he obviously does like, but he doesn't educate them. And a son called Geraint, who simply wants to get out of arts and crafts and make some money and live comfortably, and finally goes to work in the city. It's very difficult explaining.
The plot sounds very heavy the way one talks about it, but actually the way it unfolds, because it follows these family lines, it sort of unfolds with the story, which I think is a very clever piece of narrative. Tell us a bit about Olive and Tom. It seems to me that they're, as you said earlier, they're at the centre of the novel in a way, is this mother, storytelling mother, and her eldest beloved son.
One of the germs of this novel was the fact that I noticed that the children of great writers for children tend to come to grief. She builds him a sort of magical, wonderful, more than wonderful than life world out of which he can't get. One of the thoughts in my mind was Kenneth Graham's son Mouse, for whom The Wind in the Willows was written, and he simply lay down on a railway and let a train go over him when he was a student at Oxford. But I think also that with children's story writers, they're actually building a magical world for themselves. So there isn't really room for Tom in it, although he lives in it. One of the themes of the novel is the way parents love their children. And one of the sort of underlying fairy tale structures is all those Cinderella stories in which the wife dies and the father falls in love with the daughter. And when I was doing my research, I discovered that there were endless stories, fairy stories, about fathers who wanted to marry their daughters. There's only one Indian one about a mother who wants to marry her son.
The story that Olive makes up for Tom, one of the key episodes is this childhood moment when a rat eats his shadow off his feet, which strikes me as a horrific thing for a mother to write about her child. Where did that come from? Is that that's your own invention?
The rat is my invention. The taken away shadow comes from Peter Pan, because Peter Pan comes to the house of Wendy and the children, of the darlings, looking for his shadow, which has been snapped off by the window when it was shut on his shadow. And Wendy actually stitches his shadow back onto his feet. It is as though you need your second self, you need your double.
The way that you sew history and story together, it seems to me to be very, that's very particular to your fiction, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I like layered fiction. I've always admired Thomas Mann because he has a scientific structure and a, not exactly fairy tale, but a kind of mythical structure. And then a very good realist story also going on, and you go in and out of the levels of the way you take the story. And this one is about fairy stories.
But it also has vignettes. For example, there's a horrific portrait of Oscar Wilde in the very late, his very late deterioration, without any teeth, with the cave-like mouth you describe.
I was terribly excited because the day I had my midsummer party at the beginning of the novel turned out to be the day Oscar Wilde, I think, was sentenced. And so people had come rushing up from London. When I was writing about the Great Exhibition in Paris in 1900, I read that Oscar Wilde's last outing before he died was to Rodin's studio, which was set up at this exhibition. And there he, in fact, met Oscar Panizza, the obscene playwright.
And his adulthood and his deterioration, it also resonates through the novel, because there is a sort of an unpleasantness, a dangerousness about adult, particularly adult sexuality. And, of course, he was the product of his sexuality. That was what had brought him to that pass at that particular point in his history and the novel.
Yes, I think I am very interested in sort of liberated sexuality when people have, as it were, decided to be liberated and they haven't thought out the consequences of their actions. You know, if children are born of liberated sex, into which family do you slot the child of somebody having a liberated liaison?
And from these liaisons comes what you describe in that first chapter as a whole world of secret stories, some of them not so pleasant as others. And you'll just have to read it to find out exactly how wonderful and rich they are. Thank you very much.
Thank you.